Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen suffered a minor stroke over the weekend. In a statement issued last night, he said, quote, "I was admitted to George Washington University Hospital after experiencing lightheadedness and acute neck pain while I was delivering a speech in Western Maryland. At the recommendation of the attending physician, I sought medical attention upon my return home," end quote. I was in contact with the senator's spokesperson this morning in an email. Francesca Amadeo told me, "Fortunately, the senator is doing well, and it is truly out of an abundance of caution that he's staying home a few days. He plans to return to the Senate later this week." Senator Van Hollen is 63 years old. He is running for re-election to a second term. In Pennsylvania, another candidate for the Senate also suffered a minor stroke. Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is the leading candidate in the Democratic primary, which takes place there tomorrow. He spent the weekend in the hospital, and he told the Associated Press that he is on the way to a full recovery. Mr. Fetterman is 52 years old. And the white nationalist who has been arraigned on charges that he killed 10 people in a racial attack in Buffalo, New York on Saturday, was planning on targeting others after his rampage at the Tops supermarket. The Buffalo police commissioner told CNN this morning that the shooter had hoped to go to another store and continue murdering people. Police took him into custody before he was able to do that. Last Friday, we rebroadcast a conversation I had with Dr. Kathleen Ballou, who studies extremist groups. Dr. Ballou makes the point that while the targets of these attacks are sometimes different, African Americans in Charleston and Buffalo, Hispanics in El Paso, Jews in Pittsburgh, the ideology is similar. I encourage you to go to our website or our podcast and listen to Dr. Ballou's timely observations. Today on Midday, it's another installment in our series of Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is John Barron, who's running in the Democratic primary for governor. Mr. Barron has experience in both government and the nonprofit sector. Before running for governor, he was the vice president of evidence-based policy for Arnold Ventures, which describes itself as a nonpartisan philanthropic organization that works in criminal justice, education, health, and public finance. Before that, Mr. Barron served as the president of the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, an organization he founded in 2001. He also served on a presidential commission in various roles at the Department of Defense and as the lead staffer for the House Committee on Small Business. Mr. Barron is a graduate of Rice University. He holds a master's degree from Princeton and a law degree from the Yale Law School. He is 58 years old. He and his wife, Jessica, have lived in Montgomery County for 24 years. They are the parents of two grown children. This is Mr. Barron's first campaign for elective office. He has chosen Natalie Williams, the senior director of public affairs at the Maryland Business Roundtable for Education, as his lieutenant governor running mate. John Barron joins us on our digital line from Bethesda. You are welcome to join us as well if you have a question or comment for Mr. Barron. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Mr. Barron, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
So, as I mentioned, this is a first attempt at elective office for you. You're not the only person in the race for whom that's the case. Wes Moore, John King, several others. Why an attempt at elective office, and why this office in particular?
Well, I'm running for governor because Maryland isn't making progress on some major problems that damage millions of lives. And I'm offering a fundamentally different approach. In education, for example, more than a quarter of eighth graders in our state can't read at a basic level. More than a third can't do basic math. Those numbers are no different than 20 years ago. More than 500,000 Marylanders live below the poverty line, and our state has made no progress reducing our poverty rate in more than three decades. Moderate income Marylanders have seen stagnant wages since the 1980s, as income inequality has soared. Racial inequities persist in all of these areas. Our state can't just keep doing the same thing we've been doing for decades, rolling out one unproven government program after another and expect a different result. That hasn't brought progress, and it won't, because unfortunately, many programs, no matter how well-intentioned they are, just don't work. So to make progress, we need to expand solutions that don't just sound like good ideas, but have actually been tested in the real world and shown to make a big difference in people's lives. That's been the mission of my career and of the bipartisan reforms I've gotten enacted into law. I'm running because I want to bring this evidence-based approach to Maryland, and I hope to talk about some of the proven, concrete proven solutions I'd bring to our state.
Well, for example, in the area of education, the blueprint for the future, which is a product of the Kerwin Commission, would say that they've, in fact, done just what you're suggesting. They have looked at evidence-based solutions to challenges that other states have faced. Massachusetts, in particular, is singled out as a place that's had a great deal of success in improving their scores in teaching in public schools. Do you really believe that somehow over the last however many years, people haven't been looking at data, they haven't been looking at evidence, they've been ignoring evidence and just, you know, approaching these problems in an unsophisticated way?
Well, I support the blueprint legislation and would bring a very different approach to implementing it than the other candidates. So I mentioned the lack of progress over the past 20 years in education in Maryland and improving student achievement across the board. That has occurred even though Maryland saw a major increase in education spending during the 2000s, about a 40% increase in education spending per pupil after adjusting for inflation. That didn't improve student outcomes. The Kerwin Commission found that didn't improve student outcomes. This time, in implementing the blueprint, which I think has the potential to be a very serious and important turning point in education policy, but with the new resources and the blueprint, we need to focus those resources on programs and education programs and policies that have actually been tested in the real world and shown to make a big difference in people's lives. I'll give you one concrete example. As part of blueprint implementation, when I'm governor, we will provide high-quality tutoring to every struggling first and second grader in the entire state of Maryland, because that has been shown to move them up toward grade level early before their problems get serious in later grades. We're going to do this by recruiting an army of people from the community, including retirees and recent college graduates, to become tutors for a modest stipend as a public service. Essentially, this will be a statewide initiative to make sure that every child in the state of Maryland starts their educational journey with success. That kind of focus on what actually has been tested and shown to deliver results, that's what I would bring to implementation of the blueprint.
Is there anything in the blueprint that you think is ill-conceived, that is not evidence-based, that is a foolhardy attempt at solving some of these challenging problems? Are you saying that the thing that distinguishes you is the way you would implement the blueprint? Is there anything in the blueprint you think is a lousy idea?
Well, it depends on how it's implemented. The blueprint as a framework, I think, is excellent. So was 20 years ago the Thornton Commission, which resulted in that big increase in education spending during the 2000s.
And there are those who would contest that summary. They'd say that, you know, the problem with Thornton is that it was never fully funded. The money that from gambling that was supposed to go to education somehow got siphoned away for other programs. They would suggest that the reason we need the blueprint and the reason the blueprint is so expensive, relatively speaking, is because Thornton, year after year after year, was underfunded.
Well, Thornton did result in, as I mentioned, a major increase, a 40% increase in education spending per pupil during the 2000s. Funding is part of the issue. That's very important, but it's not the only piece. So, for example, many education programs, including some that might get funded, depending on how it's implemented by the blueprint, are well-intentioned, but they just don't work. For example, many teacher training programs, teacher professional development programs, when they've actually been tested, and the state spends, I think, $50 million a year on these kinds of programs, most of them, when they've actually been tested, have been found to have no effect on student achievement. There are many, many, many practices in education that, again, are well-meaning, but do not work. They don't produce the hoped-for effects. We need to focus like a laser beam on things that will actually deliver results. I gave you one example, one-on-one tutoring. Another one is career academies in high-poverty high schools. They're small communities with a career theme like healthcare or information technology, and links with local employers who provide paid internships to the high school students during the summer. They've been shown to increase long-term earnings 11 years later by about $3,000 per person, including for kids that don't go on to college, as well as those that do. So there are a number of things that could really make the difference, and that's where I would focus the blueprint funding on.
And what about folks who would say, like here in the city of Baltimore, which everybody admits has tremendous challenges when it comes to public education? A quarter of the students qualify for free meals, you know, under the government's definition of poverty. We have the kind of academies you're talking about. We have the Mervo Technical Academy. We have the Digital Harbor High School, which is a IT-focused thing. We've got the hospitality industry is represented at various places. These places exist already. So to reimagine them, I mean, I'm trying to understand how it is that you're, you claim to have an approach to governing that is fundamentally different. And I'm wondering what needs to be different, because every candidate I speak with says, here's the data, here's the statistics, and they can rattle off, as you are able to, you know, the deficiencies that we have in the current situation, and they say, here's what we have to do to fix it. I'm just trying to understand what is fundamentally different about the way you are approaching these problems than other people might approach them.
To some extent, it is making sure that the resources, to a large extent, resources are focused on expanding practices, some of which currently exist to some extent. You mentioned, you know, career academies, they do exist in parts of the state. There's also some excellent examples, not just in Baltimore, but in Howard County and elsewhere. Tutoring exists to some extent around the state, but we're talking about a real focus. So for example, when it comes to one-on-one tutoring, high-quality tutoring, we would use the resources to provide that to every struggling first and second grader in the entire state. That's about one-third of students could benefit from tutoring during first or second grade. That's a much larger scale. The other piece is it needs to be implemented effectively. That means a tutor from the community, for example, a senior citizen, who is paid a modest stipend, who is trained before they go into and do the tutoring. The tutoring needs to occur a lot. It's got to be fairly high dosage, 5 days a week, 20 minutes a day. That has been shown to move kids up, the struggling students from like the 15th percentile to about the 45th or 50th percentile in reading ability, for instance. So focusing the resources and making sure every child gets access to that kind of proven program that could make a major difference at a stage in their education where it really could be a turning point, that's the difference. Let me give you one other example of a proven program that we would expand. And again, similar to what you're saying, it exists to some extent, a limited extent already in Baltimore and other places. Those are KIPP charter schools. These are public charter schools, unionized charter schools. They're called No Excuses charter schools. They incorporate things like tutoring as well as longer school days and so on. But some of the work that my nonprofit did with the Obama administration was to scale up proven programs, including KIPP, nationally. KIPP has been shown to increase school-wide reading and math achievement in some of the most high-poverty schools by as much as 10 percentile points school-wide, and to have long-term effects on college going, about a 6 or 7% increase in college going.
Is the KIPP approach an approach that should then be done system-wide, statewide? The KIPP Ujima Academy here in Baltimore has been in existence now for well more than a decade. I don't know exactly the date it was started, but are you saying that it's because it's got a proven track record in many places, including to some extent here in Baltimore, it should be made statewide? And should there be a consensus about the KIPP approach to charter schools that everybody simply should adopt because it's in your view, the most effective way?
Well, KIPP charter schools, I don't support a general expansion in charter schools. What I'm proposing is, a sharp focus on school-wide programs like KIPP, but there are some others. KIPP is probably the leading example. It's implemented on a large scale in many states, not just Maryland. But it has been shown to be extremely effective when implemented on a large scale. So yes, we should be expanding these significantly in the state of Maryland. KIPP, but also there are some schools called that are very promising. The evidence isn't quite there, but Core Knowledge is another type of charter school that's also been found effective. And some of the charter schools, Promise Academy and Harlem Children's Zone, there are a number of other promising models, but there are certain types of proven charter school models. These are public charter schools that we should be expanding for the simple reason they work. They really improve student achievement in a fundamental way.
John Barron, he's a candidate for governor in the Democratic primary. You can join our conversation after a quick break, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1. WYPR.
Hi, I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Hala Vince.
In the coming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll be sharing five advantages of health savings accounts and also some key findings from a new report on the rapidly evolving workplace. You can find the Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life podcast on WYPR's website and mobile app, wherever you get your podcasts, and at transamericainstitute.org.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be John Waters. The filmmaker, actor, and visual artist has a new book. It's his first novel. It's called Liar Mouth, A Feel-Bad Romance. And it's a book that only John Waters could write. It'll be fun to talk with him about it tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is John Barron. He is one of 10 candidates running in the Democratic primary for governor. Other contenders include Comptroller Peter Franchot, former Prince George's County Executive Rashearn Baker, former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, author and former nonprofit executive Wes Moore, former Maryland Attorney General Doug Gansler, and John King, a former U.S. Secretary of Education. If you have a question or comment for John Barron, you can reach us at 410-662-8780. You can email us at midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Mr. Barron, I want to talk about public safety. Here this weekend we have this other, yet another heinous act of racial hatred in Buffalo, New York. And when this happens, these kinds of things happen, and they happen with, frightening, horrifying frequency. We look to political leaders to protect against extremist violence and daily violence on the streets of cities like Baltimore. I mean, 10 people were shot in Buffalo on Saturday, and last Tuesday, 10 people were shot in in Baltimore. One of them died, and several were injured. This is an ongoing project problem. Rod Rosenstein, in 2017, just after he was appointed Deputy Attorney General in the Justice Department, said that crime is out of control because political leaders have let it get out of control. Do you agree that political leaders have the capacity, and is there evidence in your thinking of things that should be done to alleviate this horrible epidemic of violence in cities like Baltimore and in places throughout the state?
I do believe that public officials, elected officials, can do much, much better on public safety. The incident in Buffalo and others around the country, it just seems like they keep coming and coming. It's terrible. It is frightening, as you said. It's unacceptable. It feels like the social fabric is coming apart in some ways. There are certain concrete things we can do. Maryland actually has very good gun laws. And I supported efforts, and I was proud of the General Assembly for passing the ban on ghost guns. There are things that we can do that would actually add to the effectiveness. One of them is on the topic of gun storage. So a significant number of homicides and suicides occur because people get access to unsecured guns. They're either stolen or, in some cases, there was an analysis a few years ago that for school shootings, more than half of them were youth who got a hold of their parents' guns that were not secured. So in the area of gun storage, we can do much more. There's common sense legislation that Massachusetts and Oregon have both implemented that requires gun owners, when they're not actually using the gun, to have that gun stored and locked within their house. And there's some evidence that people, when it's provided, when it's mandated, people actually use it. So the guns aren't lying around. They're not accessible to either people who might steal the guns or to children or people who are, you know, potentially suicidal or homicidal. That's one important step we can take. Regarding crime in Baltimore, there are some crime-fighting strategies that have been tested elsewhere and found to be very effective. As one example, focused deterrence. This is a crime-fighting approach that recognizes that more than half of all violent crime is carried out by people who are, by a relatively modest number of individuals, people who are repeat violent offenders, often they're gang involved. And what this approach does, it invites these individuals in for meetings with public officials, community leaders, social service agencies, and law enforcement, and offers them a positive path forward, like job training or educational opportunities, but also makes clear in these meetings that if these individuals continue to act violently, they will be the focus of extraordinary attention from law enforcement. So there's a positive way forward, but there's also a strong enforcement component. Now, in a number of cities, but including Oakland, California, this approach of focused deterrence was associated with a 50% reduction in homicides over a period of 5 years. It's very promising. We should be trying it. And as governor, I would be a full partner with Baltimore and other jurisdictions in bringing it to Maryland.
Yeah, we did a story about the situation in Oakland, and they did have 5 or so years where there was significant progress in reducing the amount of violence on Oakland streets. And then that progress was reversed over the last few years, the way it's been reversed in cities like New York and Atlanta, and certainly here in Baltimore. I mean, a lot of folks would say, look, focused deterrence has been part of the game plan here in Baltimore for a long time. We have groups like ROCA who are reaching out to individuals, even those individuals who may be reluctant to be reached out to. We have Safe Streets initiatives, violence interrupters going in and trying to, you know, resolve conflicts before they reach a level of violence. We have a number of programs. The mayor here, Mayor Scott, talks about a holistic approach to violence reduction. I mean, these are things that have been tried, that are currently being tried with a number of hospital-based violence interrupting programs. I mean, these are approaches that a lot of people are currently trying. I wonder, do you think that Larry Hogan and Brandon Scott and Brian Frosch as the Attorney General, or Marilyn Mosby as the state's attorney here in the city of Baltimore, are responsible? Is it their responsibility? Is it their fault that crime has not been reduced here in our city, given the fact that it's also not been reduced in virtually any other city across the country as well?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in Oakland, they did, and other cities, New Orleans as well. Oakland saw a major reduction when the strategy was put in place. And there've been a number of articles on this. When they were no longer able to implement the strategy of focused deterrence in a meaningful way during the pandemic, crime rates started to rise again. But the evidence is pretty consistent. When you can implement focused deterrence with integrity, faithfully, implement its main components, you really do see a reduction in crime. Now, in Baltimore, I strongly applaud efforts by Police Chief Harrison and the mayor and others to launch this approach. What is needed in terms of full implementation is additional resources from the state, both on the positive resources that can be offered to some of these repeat violent offenders to help them find a better path, but also, and most importantly, in terms of what's missing, there needs to be a strong law enforcement component. So the positive way forward, but a strong enforcement component to make sure that all pieces of this strategy are fully implemented to get the results we're hoping for. There are other, in terms of whose fault it is, I don't like talking about fault. Let's just look forward.
I'm just wondering about responsibility. In other words, Should people expect that the people they elect to statewide and citywide office be able to reduce the number of murders that are taking place on a daily basis?
Yes, they should expect that. Focused deterrence is one piece of it. There are other highly effective approaches that have been tried elsewhere that have also been shown to reduce violent crime and other kinds of crime. As one example, community policing in hot spots. So more than half of all city crime actually occurs this is basically policing that is focused on the city blocks where more than half of all crime occurs.
Right. Commissioner Harrison refers to those as microzones.
That's right.
And
yes.
Those microzones are being, revised constantly, depending on where the data shows that the crimes are being committed. So, these are programs that I think a lot of folks currently in office and working in the public safety arena are trying. I do want to go to the phones to Farouk. He's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with John Barron.
Yeah, good afternoon, sir. Mr. John, you are applying for the position of the governor. I have a very quick question. Your resume is saying that have you ever worked in any city government, county government, any kind of this kind of government? Number two, what kind of experience you have in the health industry, health department? What kind of experience you have in the business? When you have a business, you have employment. And what kind of experience you have in a finance, budget and all these? These are the main requirements to get the position of the governor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for your comment, Farouk. So, Mr. Barron, your experience has not been in elective office. You have worked in government. How does your experience pertain to the challenges you would face if you're elected governor?
So, Farouk, thank you very much for that question. So the through line of my career has been committed to public service, and I have been able to drive major policy change at the federal, state, and local level, working with members of both parties. In the Clinton administration, I was a Clinton appointee. I headed a roughly $1 billion technology program, which had a lot of moving parts. We made reforms that that were awarded the Vice President's Award for Reinventing Government. They were extremely successful. Some of the reforms that we pushed through were cited by the Clinton administration as some of their main achievements in the area of high-tech economic development. Later, I founded and ran for 14 years a business, a nonprofit business, that worked with the Bush and the Obama administrations and Congress to get a number of major reforms in social spending programs enacted into law that produced big gains in education, earnings, and healthcare in Maryland for people in Maryland and across the country. Most recently, I headed the largest philanthropic initiative in the nation that identifies and expands proven effective social programs. And I've been an appointee of Democratic and Republican presidents. So the ability to work with members, people in the community, people in elective office and so on, to advance major policy change is something that I would bring to the position.
When it comes to implementing programs, once one decides, you know, this the evidence points to program X or Y, and when it comes to actually implementing those programs on a government-wide basis, do you think that here in the state of Maryland there is a need for a different approach to implementation in general? In other words, is the culture of the state government here in Maryland sufficient to enact programs that the legislature deems appropriate and the governor signs into law? I mean, I'm thinking about the Labor Department at the beginning of the pandemic, in which they were just simply overwhelmed and could not handle the demand for unemployment insurance. I'm thinking about the comptroller's office. And, of course, the current comptroller is a candidate in the race for the Democratic nomination for governor, where one calls the office with questions about taxes in the tax season, and we're told that there's no one who can answer your call. Call back later. We have the comptroller making claims that these calls are answered right away and problems are resolved quickly. There's certainly significant evidence to the contrary for that. How do you get government to have a customer service culture that actually is efficient and effective?
So my running mate, Natalie Williams, and I would bring a very different governing approach to our state. We need a different governing approach if we're going to solve major problems like the ones I mentioned earlier. The bottom 40% of Marylanders have seen stagnant wages since the 1980s, as one example. I mean, just think about that for a second. The education numbers, they've been stagnant for 20 years. A quarter of middle school students can't read. Let me give you a concrete example of the different approach that I would take. So in the area of employment, labor you mentioned, job training, the largest job training program in the United States is a federal Department of Labor program. It has been around since the 1970s. It's a multi-billion dollar program. In Maryland alone, it's close to $30 million a year. So it's a big program. A study came out a couple years ago showing that the workers who get trained in this program end up with wages that are roughly the same as the workers who don't. In other words, this is a well-intentioned program. It has been around since the 1970s and been renamed in various forms. It is not achieving its results, its intended results. And people are putting their time and energy into getting training, trying to get ahead, and it is not working. By contrast, there are some other kinds of job training approaches that we do not now implement on a large scale that my philanthropic group played a major role in developing and expanding, that are much more effective, that produce 20 to 40% increases in earnings sustained over time for low and moderate income people. The difference is the key to effectiveness. So just to say this, As governor, one of my main priorities would be to launch a statewide partnership with employers, with businesses across the state, to provide effective job training to every young adult in the entire state who wants to advance. If it's done right, job training has been shown to increase earnings by 20 to 40%. The key is, number one, to focus that training on fast-growing industries like IT or healthcare, where there are well-paying jobs. And number two, to work hand-in-hand with employers in the design of that training so it meets the employer's needs. And the employers then provide paid internships to the trainees and pick up half the bill. So under my plan, the state will pay for the training, the employers pay for the internships, our economy gets skilled workers, everyone benefits. We need to refocus, to sum up, we need to refocus the existing money, which is not delivering results, on programs and policies that will actually produce big gains in living standards for the people who participate.
John Barron is one of 10 candidates in the Democratic primary for governor. Mr. Barron, if you're able, if you could stick with us until the top of the hour, we'd be grateful for the opportunity to continue our conversation after a quick break. Is that all right with you?
That sounds great. Thank you.
All right. Before we go to that break, though, each week here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2022, 125 people have lost their lives to violence in our city. Lee Jordan Butler was 30 years old. His death was reported the week before last. Austin Hammond died last September. Last week, medical examiners ruled his death a homicide. Austin Hammond was 1 year old. Police have released the names of 8 people who were victims of homicide last week. They are Miguel Soto Diaz, age 35, Kenneth Taylor, age 39, Chone Cummings, age 25, Samuel McCoy, age 33, Cartrell Babulal, age 32, Jasmine Brunson, age 18, Yamel Montague, age 37, and Angel Smith. She was 38 years old, and the baby she delivered after her shooting is in critical condition. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We had hoped to speak with Kevin Lyles, a music entrepreneur who has some plans for a big party at the Preakness, and Mr. Lyles just let us know that he's not available to speak with us. So instead, I'm delighted that we can continue our conversation with John Barron. He is one of 10 candidates in the Democratic primary for governor of Maryland. That primary takes place on the 19th of July. The 7th of July is the first day of early voting. If you want to vote by mail, you've got to request a mail-in ballot from either your local or state board of election. Our number here, if you'd like to join our conversation with John Barron, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Mr. Barron, one of the issues that's of great concern to folks here in Baltimore, particularly 10 or 12 neighborhoods in the central Baltimore area, is that of State Center, the redevelopment of State Center, which is a project that has just slogged on for decade after decade. This began in the Ehrlich administration. There was a consensus among the neighborhoods that are contiguous to the State Center development, and a plan was put in place. Mr. Hogan, the governor, and as a matter of fact, Mr. Franchot, who also serves on the Board of Public Works, voted against continuing that contract, despite the fact that it had been in the works for, a dozen years or so. What do you think of that decision, and in terms of an evidence-based approach that you would employ as governor, how would that impact and inform your plans for State Center?
Well, I would need to look at the specifics of State Center. But in general, my approach in this area is we need effective programs for economic and business development. We should have a process at the state level that is merit-based in terms of allocating the funds, where you have panels of experts looking at what is going to be most effective, and also combined with the needs of the community, so that more disadvantaged or poor communities have an advantage in the funding process for that reason, as well as having an effective project. But there needs to be a competitive process at the state level to determine which projects get funded.
What is the role of government, state government in particular, when it comes to job creation, job development, and economic growth? You mentioned job training programs. There are a number of programs here in Baltimore and around the state that are currently in place. And there are a number of people hoping to scale those up. Mayor Scott here in Baltimore has allocated several million dollars from the American Rescue Plan funds towards job training programs, some of which resemble the ones you were talking about before the break. But overall, what can the state do? What should the state do to accommodate economic growth?
Well, this, I think, is the biggest economic problem by far in Maryland, that the bottom 40% of Maryland households have seen stagnant wages since the 1980s after you adjust for inflation, while income inequality has soared. The American narrative of optimism and progress, the idea that each generation will do better than the last, it no longer applies to nearly half of our people. That isn't normal. It isn't the way things used to be. Between the end of World War II and about 1980, the incomes of everyone were rising. And for the bottom 40% in particular in the United States, they more than doubled during that time period after adjusting for inflation. We need to have, and you do wonder whether all of the anger and division and the cynicism that we see in our country today, you wonder how much of that is due to the lack of progress and whether things would be very different now on that front if things had continued as they had after World War II and everybody was seeing a rising tide to lift all boats and the income of the bottom 40% had doubled again. So I think this is a fundamentally important issue and would be a top priority of my administration. Again, we can't keep doing the same old thing, including in job training and employment programs. Many of them, as I mentioned earlier, are well-intentioned but do not actually improve people's economic well-being, including the largest job training program in the United States. We need to have focused job training and other jobs programs that have been tested and shown to work. I gave examples before of job training that has been focused, that's focused on fast-growing industries and their close partnerships with local employers who provide internships. They've been shown to increase earnings 20 to 40%. As one other example, career academies in high-poverty high schools, I mentioned that earlier, that have a career theme and links with local employers. We need programs like that have been shown to increase earnings, 11 years later by $3,000 per person. We need programs like that for kids who go on to college as well as those who don't. More than half of Marylanders right now, young people in Maryland, don't complete a college degree. There needs to be a way for those students to get the education, training, and skills they need to succeed in the workforce. That would really be, that this would be a top priority of my administration.
What is your path to victory? Democrats need to choose the person who can take back the governor's office after 8 years of Larry Hogan, who's particularly popular with Republicans and Democrats. Some 61%, according to the most recent Goucher poll, say that Larry Hogan, 61% of Democrats say Mr. Hogan's done a good job, even though he is a Republican governor. The registration proportion heavily favors Democrats here in the state of Maryland, 2-1. But how can a John Barron candidacy in a general election compete with a well-funded Republican opponent, which very well may be Kelly Schultz, former Commerce Secretary, who has been endorsed by Mr. Hogan, and I think it will run a campaign similar to Mr. Hogan's appeal across the aisle to independents and Democrats alike.
Well, my message is a bipartisan one. And it resonates in my experience throughout my career in advancing this message and also on the campaign trail is that it resonates and really connects with people who are independents, moderate Republicans, as well as Democrats. I am not advocating a major expansion in state spending or taxes or the size of government. What I'm advocating is a major increase in the effectiveness of government. The idea that the tax dollars and the spending that we do make should be focused on programs that actually deliver results and improve people's lives in a major way. And in all of my experience working with people on both sides of the aisle in Congress and in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, to advance this concept, this resonates in a bipartisan way. My experience on the campaign trail is the same. This is a message. It's a unifying message that I think will win. It will win in a general election because it appeals across the spectrum.
Do you have concerns about your name recognition? I mean, the sort of the logistics of politics. People know Wes Moore, Peter Francho, Rashern Baker, Tom Perez because of their positions in the public eye over many years. I mean, you are a newcomer to elective office. Do you think that is going to be a barrier that will be difficult to overcome in a general election?
Well, there are 9 candidates running right now. It is widely considered to be a fluid field, wide open. This is a typical scenario where, with 9 candidates splitting the vote, no clear front runner, this is a typical scenario where a new face can break through with a compelling message. I do have a compelling message. It's very concrete. As I mentioned, it is a message that appeals across the spectrum. It's very different than the other candidates. We all share similar goals. We all want to improve education and, you know, economic opportunity and the rest. But what the others are proposing is rolling out one unproven government program after another. We've done that. We've been doing that for decades. What I'm proposing is something very different, a sharp focus on expanding solutions that don't just sound good, aren't just well-meaning, aren't just spending money, but have actually been tested in the real world and shown to produce major improvements in people's lives. We also have the resources to get that message out widely on the airwaves. We'll be doing that closer to the election, to go out on TV and social media to boost name recognition and to get this effective message out there in a very robust way.
I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to call it. We are out of time. John Barron is a Democrat in the Democratic primary for governor here in Maryland. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Barron. I appreciate it.
Tom, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity. It was great to talk with you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, John Waters joins me. He's written a novel. It's called Liar Mouth, a Feel-Bad Romance. And it's always fun to speak with John. So we will talk about his debut novel tomorrow here on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Rob Sibbeck's our senior producer. Mallory Pinker-Pierre is our supervising producer. Jamila Kremple is WIPR's digital content director. And Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Here and Now is up next after news at the top of the hour. Don't forget to download the Daily Dose. That's WIPR's compendium of local news put together by the WIPR news team. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your being with us today here on Midday. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.